This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode we'll be discussing the cult of President Xi. We'll also be looking at the Palmerian Church in Spain. And finally, we'll be discussing why good girls fall for bad boys. First, China is having its 19th Party Congress, and for the first time since the death of Chairman Mao 4 decades ago, a personality cult is emerging in China, says Cindy Yu. Cindy joins me now. So Cindy, in your piece you talk about being in Beijing and seeing pictures of President Xi's face all over. Is that not what always happens before a party congress?
No, absolutely. It is absolutely what always happens before a party congress. So I say in my piece that this sort of adulation for an individual leader is nothing new in China. But what is actually very, very special about this congress is the way that anyone else new has been treated in the run-up to the congress. So every congress can be seen as a cabinet reshuffle, essentially. Whereas right now, we should be seeing rising stars nurtured, vetted, aligned for running the government in 5 years' time when Xi's terms end, we're not seeing any of that. So whereas the propaganda will always and is always there, but what's actually happening is that it's corresponding with actual action where his enemies are being rooted out.
And how has he managed to do that?
So the biggest tool that Xi Jinping has been using for rooting out his enemies is the anti-corruption campaign, which is something of a trademark of his since his rise to power 5 years ago. What he does is that he actually conducts inspections, governmental inspections, every year or so from the very bottom up from each of the provinces, finding out about embezzlings, about gift giving. And there is a huge culture of that in China. So my mother actually is an antique dealer and her business had been fueled by gift giving, high-ranking officials giving ancient Chinese antiques to other officials or business leaders in order to get things done. But obviously that's not the recipe for functioning government. And so Xi's promise has been to root out that, and he has done that. But in the process, he has also got rid of his enemies who have, whether truthfully or not, been embezzling, been accepting gifts. And so two of his most high-profile victims are Bo Xilai from 2012, who was, you know, tipped to be president, and then earlier this year, Sun Zhencai, who was also tipped to be president. And of course, neither are in the Politburo anymore.
Would it be fair to say that the anti-corruption campaign is basically a sort of old-fashioned way of purging people who are your political enemies?
I think that's a valid viewpoint, but I don't think it's entirely fair, because, as I say, there is a huge culture of corruption in China in any case, and we have seen real changes. So when I was in China earlier this year, I was talking to one of my cousins who works for the Chinese Communist Party, and he was telling me the difference that Xi Jinping has brought to even a small fry like his life in the party. Today, these days, they're afraid to give gifts in when they go out for business lunches and dinners, and one of his colleagues actually was caught on tape accepting a gift and lost his job because of it. It really has had an impact and a fair impact on rooting out corruption, but at the same time, it is a purge. It is absolutely being used as a purge too.
You also talk in your piece about the Chinese military, and you talk about how Xi is basically becoming a sort of commander in chief. Do you think we can now expect him to be slightly more aggressive militarily?
Absolutely, I definitely think so. It is slightly hair-raising how much he is reconstructing the military for his own purposes. As I say in the piece, he's literally changing the structure of the military to make factional rivalry less strong, because historically have been quite strong powers, oppositional powers to the president. By doing this, he's split the four traditional factions into 15 different agencies, and so each of them individually has less power against him. At the same time, he's already been very, very aggressive in his diplomacy and foreign policy. So we have the disputed islands in the East and South China Seas, where Xi Jinping has just come out and said, you know what, the UN, I don't agree with your ruling that the Spratly Islands are the Philippines. You know, they're mine, and I'm going to do military exercises there. He's also been flaunting around his aircraft carrier, his own one and only so far, but another one's coming very soon, around the Taiwan Strait, supposedly very nonchalantly, but somewhat suspiciously during the time of the Taiwan election. And so we have already seen from President Xi a very aggressive approach to foreign policy in terms of setting down China's borderies. It is a Monroe Doctrine of kind. And I think with greater control of the military from this restructuring, we can see more of that later years.
You mentioned the word hair-raising just then, and in the start of your piece you talk about the kind of nightmare of the Cultural Revolution and how terrifying it was. Is there a sense in China right now that it's slightly, is there sort of nervousness about a new personality cult, or are people excited about it?
I don't think there is nervousness, because I think we often forget the lessons we learn from history. And I think that Chinese people have differentiated Xi Jinping to Chairman Mao in a very valid way, which is that Xi Jinping has long-term growth in mind. The Cultural Revolution was a problem because Mao wasn't done with his revolution. Once he settled into government, he realised, wait a minute, I have become who I was fighting against. And so he wanted to rouse the youth up into another revolution against the establishment, but that's never sustainable. What the difference with Xi Jinping is that he is seeing China as a modern power. He is looking at Putin's model in Russia and seeing, how can we make this sustainable? How can we make a long-term personality cult sustainable? And the way to do that is actually by having some effective policies, such as anti-corruption, and such as economic initiatives, restructuring debt, and also his Belt and Road Initiative, which is just going to increase regional border trade. And very recently, which close to our hearts, is the trade deals done with Britain, of course, and that's not unique to China's dealings with the rest of the world. So Xi is really trying to push China's model, and I think he's doing it in quite an enlightened way. So it's not about himself, but it is about China's growth, but at the same time, he is integral to that model.
And the model seems to be moving away from a kind of Western form of democracy. Does that make people in China nervous, or do people actually look at what's happened to kind of, you know, in America with Trump and in Europe and think, actually, maybe that's not the right model?
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming sentiment is that people in glass houses should not be throwing stones. When I was talking to university students in China earlier this year, and when I was talking to family members as well, you know, everyone's asking me, what's going on over there? What's going on with Brexit? What's going on with Trump? Who thought democracy was a good idea? And, you know, I asked them this question, do you not feel that you're politically participating, that you're not missing out on something? And they said, well, you know what, maybe people shouldn't politically participate if it leads to results like this. You know, Xi Dada obviously knows what he's doing. And we put
Xi Dada, that's Father Xi. That's
yes, the Papa term. Xi, yes, okay. An endearing term that's actually come from the internet, from social media.
And yeah. people use that term
somewhat ironically, but mostly seriously, and just to refer to him endearingly, really.
And would you just say, finally, that younger people are kind of getting behind him?
Yes, I think that's something really notable. So, for example, with Xi Dada, it comes from social media, and that is mainly driven by young people. And I think with any successful personality leadership, I mean, you look at Corbyn, you look at Chairman Mao, Freudian comparison there, but the support of the youth is what makes you different and what makes your religion, as it were, your personality truly successful.
Sure, and I suppose the young don't remember the Cultural Revolution in the same way that younger people here don't remember
absolutely
what life was like in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. I think this personality cult is different in kind to the Cultural Revolution itself, but it is the same sort of personality cult that led to the Cultural Revolution. So I don't think Xi Jinping is bringing about that sort of revolution at all at the moment, but you're absolutely right. Young people are not taught about the Cultural Revolution. Their parents talk about it in whispers, and no one really knows what it was. No one really understands what it is. Internet censorship has only got stronger. So they are, I suppose, they are lax about the possibility of one person strong-handing everything. But at the same time, they are also very intelligent. They are educated, they are intelligent, they are aware of the world because of the internet. And so they are making, you know, somewhat rational choices, evaluations about the president.
And now, for a bit more on China, I'm now joined by Jonathan Fenby and Kerry Brown to discuss the new Chinese empire. Jonathan, you suggest that China's now ditched the advice to hide its strength and bide its time. What would you say its new approach is?
Its new approach is to try to establish, I think, a political and a broader presence globally, commensurate with the economic weight which it's acquired over the last 35 years or so. And this operates, this takes effect in many, many different ways, some diplomatic, some business, some strategic, some tactical. But this is a work in progress. On the other hand, it's, if you talk about a Chinese empire going out of China at the moment, it's very different from the old idea we had of a British or a French or a Spanish empire, or of the hegemony which the United States established after the Second World War. This is very much driven, in my analysis, by domestic considerations in China itself, particularly under Xi Jinping, as he accumulates more and more power and moves into the key five-yearly party congress.
Kerry, what do you make of
China's empire building at this point?
Well, I think it's partly what, as Jonathan said, that they've had this opportunity, and partly they've been pushed into this position by the kind of hapless leadership in the rest of the world. So I don't think that they were planning to have an American president who has done their work for them so well. And I don't think they were quite planning to have a Europe that was so sort of keen to kind of cede markets to them in ways that they probably weren't expecting. So it's partly serendipitous, partly, I think, quite a treacherous moment for China, because, you know, they're in grasp of this amazing amount of influence, and yet do they in modern history have this kind of ability? That's not clear.
Yes, well, I agree. I mean, this historically, people always talk about, you know, the Qing Empire around 1800 having represented a third of world wealth, the great Chinese Empire, and so on. But with very rare exceptions, these dynasties in China didn't go outside China much. They wanted tributary respect in the region in particular, but they felt themselves to be pretty self-sufficient. And this is a big change. And as Kerry says, how that is actually handled by Beijing, which has always been used to a series of relatively short-term bilateral relationships abroad, rather than building up the kind of alliances or the permanent presence on the ground which we normally associate with expanding great powers.
Do you think they have a long-term plan, or do they tend to think more in the short term?
I mean, so it's a sort of slightly different way of answering that question, but the two things that are unprecedented, which I don't think they could really plan, are firstly, we've never known in modern history a China which is a sea power. I mean, it's been a land power. So, I mean, it's never really been active in that area. The second is the world outside China knows how to deal with a weak China. And in modern history, we've got lots of experience of how to deal with a weak China. And China has lots of experience of believing itself to be a victim, having resentments about history, and being a weak actor. We do not know how to deal with a strong China. And China doesn't know what it's like as a strong actor, but it's learning. And that is a huge responsibility for the world outside, because we need new frameworks to deal with this thing called China. And China itself is using a new language, like Xi Jinping at Davos, using this amazing sort of globalization language, and yet it's a one-party Marxist-Leninist state.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to what Kerry was saying earlier, you couldn't have scripted it better, in a sense, over the last, what, 6-9 months and so on. I mean, you get the moment towards the end of last year when Donald Trump tweeted that he was going to take the US out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which it probably would have gone out of in any case, given Democrat opposition to it. But that very weekend, Xi Jinping was at an Asian-Pacific summit in Peru, and the Chinese immediately hit this kind of, we are the great globalizing trading, free trading nation, trading agreements a nation, and we've got an alternative, by the way, to the TPP, which doesn't have all those nasty restrictions in it on labor laws, on environmental laws, on legal protection, and so on. For you other developing countries, you'll be much freer to do as you want. And China's moved in, has been given all these vacuums to move into, again, with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the whole One Belt, One Road, which I think at the moment is largely, with the exception probably of Pakistan, it's largely a political influence game rather than actually a solid investment at the moment. But in all those things, and then, as Kerry says, with Xi Jinping's appearance at Davos, where he was suddenly embraced by the free marketeers of the world as if he was running, you know, an open democratic country.
He's now prioritising national interests over international ones. Is that sustainable for this great power?
Well, so his mandate, his domestic political mandate, is to make one party rule sustainable. And everything flows into that. So there is an emperor of China, and it's called the Communist Party of China. And he's largely until now its servant, although he could become a more autonomous actor and may well become so. And so re-legitimising the party by a nationalistic sort of message is not something new. I mean, that was happening with the sort of language about historic mission in the Hu Jintao era. But under Xi Jinping, I think you've got, so Xinhua recently did a kind of piece to the Chinese news agency about Xi Jinping, the storyteller. So he has been a very good leader at capturing the narrative. And the narrative is a China which goes for win-win outcomes, a China which is creating this Pax Sinica, a China which is basically, you know, it's our biggest friend in terms of climate change and in terms of free trade deals. But underneath that, we have to remember, what are we buying into? We're buying into sustainability of the one-party state. So we are also ceding huge territory.
Yeah, in the end, I think, as everything else I would say in China, it comes down to buttressing and strengthening the control of the empire as represented, the internal empire this is, as represented by the Communist Party. And that's what Xi Jinping's all about. That's what the anti-corruption campaign is about. That's what, you know, the management of the economy as growth slows down is about. All this is to ensure that the Communist Party remains in power. And I think foreign affairs will be modulated with that end in mind, with probably a lot of fairly short-term questions. And of course, on North Korea, we've had a basic question as to whether the big brother of China can get the little brother in Pyongyang to do what it wants. And the answer has been no. And how the big brother Communist Party reacts to that may in the end be an interesting challenge for Xi Jinping at home, because on the other hand, he doesn't want to get involved in any approach to North Korea where China is being, or is being seen as being, led by the United States. The national sovereignty is always primary in this.
Jonathan, is it fair to say that China's becoming slightly more sceptical of the West, just at the point that the West seems to be becoming slightly more interested in China?
Well, the West has at the same time become suspicious of China. It's become aware that China isn't just this great market of, you know, billion plus people, which is longing to buy Western goods. It's become aware that when China talks about harmonious rise or its peaceful intentions and so on, that is always with China's interests prime in mind. But at the same time, I mean, we don't know what Donald Trump really thinks about China. At one moment, after meeting Xi Jinping in Florida, they had this very great relationship. And then a few weeks later, China had let America down. The trade talks, which finished this summer, don't seem to have got anywhere, I think, basically because both sides were on completely different wavelengths through that. And Europe, at the same time, is aware that it needs to craft a policy towards China, but it's been aware of that for what, 30 years, and hasn't really got anywhere. So you've got, you know, Merkel saying we have to build a strategic relationship. You had the last UK government seeking this golden era with China and so on. But nobody really knows how to deal with this. And the question, as Kerry was saying at the moment, is how China really sees itself, I think, as dealing with the rest of the world. And that is far from clear.
Kerry, just finally, once Britain leaves the EU, do you think there are going to be new opportunities for UK-Chinese relations?
Yes, there will. We don't have the human capital, in a sense, to sort of deal with China. I mean, we produce 300 graduates in Chinese language a year in the UK, and that's not increased since the late 1990s. We can sign free trade agreements until, you know, the cows or whatever you want come home, but that doesn't mean that we're going to be able to do deals with Chinese companies that are going to be very different, and probably, usually with free trade agreements, the bigger partner kind of wins. So China will be win-winning, and it'll be China winning twice. So behind all of this, for the UK and for everyone else, is the question that hovers over everything, which is, we don't know what a world or a region run according to Chinese values is. I mean, Chinese values are very kind of amorphous, you know, it's almost like a syncretic tradition of having three totally alternative belief systems, Buddhism, Taoism and Confucianism, now Marxism. We don't know what a world is like, you know, with that value system more dominant and more prevalent. And it is now in a bigger space because the doubts about the American or European value system are clear. So this is a profound kind of moment of modernity where we have a totally different value system becoming really important to us. And the UK is probably going to learn what that means quicker than most others because of its moment of exposure with China.
That was Cindy Yu, Jonathan Femby and Kerry Brown.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Hi, I'm Sam Leith, host of the Spectator Books podcast. And in this week's episode, we've got Claire Tomalin, the very distinguished literary editor and literary biographer, talking about her memoir, A Life of My Own, which describes her difficult marriage and rackety but triumphant progress through the literary scene of the 80s, 70s and 90s.
Next, in this week's issue of The Spectator, Damien Thompson says that the truth about the Palmarian Catholic Church is stranger than Dan Brown's fiction. Damien joins me now. Damien, what is the Palmarian Church?
The Palmarian Church is, up to a point, as Dan Brown describes it, an international network of very bizarre quasi-Catholics run by a pope who genuinely does have bloody great cathedral on the Andalusian plain, which is heavily fortified. And there they celebrate exotic ceremonies in enormously gaudy vestments and loathe the modern world. And in the past have kept their followers following extremely strict rules. No jeans, they could only smoke a certain number of cigarettes a day. Pregnant women could smoke 6 cigarettes a day, which I actually think is quite liberal. Oh, they weren't allowed to wash, or they weren't given washing facilities, so there was, inside the convents apparently there was a bit of a smell. But the Pope himself, the original Palmerian Pope, who declared himself Pope in 1978, was a blind man. He lost his eyeballs in an accident, poor man, but it makes the footage of him receiving visions of Jesus inside this enormous cathedral rather sinister, I must say, when he rolls his head up to see Jesus. But his own lifestyle actually was considerably less austere. He was into heavy drinking, flamenco, and boys. As he admitted, he said he was tempted all the time by the devil, and that was more or less okay, so long as everybody else followed the savage regimes that he set out for them. But what Dan Brown doesn't really mention is the extraordinary cosmology of this church, which has declared that the Virgin Mary is present in the sacrament, so you're receiving her as well as Jesus Christ when you take the wafer, and also St. Joseph. But there are planets, as there often are in these new religions, and one planet is called the Planet of Mary, and it's occupied by entirely sinless souls and angels who will come to the aid of the Palmerian Church when the apocalypse happens. And they've announced the apocalypse several times and, unsurprisingly, had to adjust the date when it didn't happen.
And how does the Catholic Church view the Palmerian Church?
Well, it's not in especially close communion with it. There's no ecumenical dialogue, I have to say. Actually, it's a bit of a problem because this Palmerian Pope, the original one, Gregory, who was ordained in 1978, declared himself Pope. He was ordained a bishop. Problem is, he was ordained a bishop by a genuine Roman Catholic archbishop, the former Archbishop of Hue in Vietnam, and that gave him sort of valid orders, even if they weren't recognised by the Catholic Church. He had this strange situation where he was illicitly but validly ordained. So in other words, technically he's more of a bishop than the Archbishop of Canterbury, which is awkward.
And why do you think Dan Brown's gone back to another Catholic, he obviously wrote about Opus Dei. Why do you think he's gone back to another Catholic group?
Well, I think somebody's just said, hey, have you heard about these people? And he's read it. And typically for Dan Brown, there are serious inaccuracies in what he says. When he wrote about Opus Dei, he talked about an albino monk. Well, Opus Dei gets up to many things, but it doesn't actually have monks. He repeats the libel, and it is a serious libel, that the Palmerians have canonised Hitler. They haven't. That's put about by ex-members, of whom there's quite a number, unsurprisingly, given how horribly they were treated. They haven't canonised Hitler. They have, however, canonised Franco. And that caused a bit of a problem a couple of years back because they put up a statue of Franco outside their basilica, and it's actually against the law in Spain to put up a statue of the Generalissimo, so they had to take it down. And many other people, and also the Palmerian popes have been lavish in creating their own cardinals. It's one of those churches, it's quite typical of these small denominations, where there'll be more sort of cardinals and bishops in the church than actual worshippers.
Is it just in Spain, or are there Palmerian churches dotted around the world?
Curiously, at its height in the 1980s, there were Palmerian churches all over Latin America. Nigeria, they were, I say big there, they certainly had a presence there. In the Far East, in the Philippines, and in Ireland. For some reason, maybe it was the Mariolatry. They more or less worship Mary as a god that appealed to certain Irish people. A lot of the embittered ex-members are Irish.
At the end of your piece, also, you talk about this idea of religion moving to the fringes. Do you think we're sort of going to see more of these breakaway groups?
Yes, I do.
Over the coming years?
Yes, I do. There was an idea that religion itself would die out, or that religion would become ever more sort of conventional. And certainly, you know, the Church of England and the Catholic Church, and with its committees and things, become ever more like select committees. But the fringes flourish, and they especially flourish in Africa, which is becoming the worldwide centre of Christianity, especially Catholicism and variants of Catholicism. So already in Africa, you have countless autocephalous, that's the word from the, you know, running themselves, churches which invent their own doctrines, or their doctrines are revealed to them. Got to remember that every religion started with somebody inventing it, at least in the eyes of the secular world, before I get myself into too much trouble with my fellow Catholics, but began with a series of revelations. Well, church leaders, whether they're Pentecostals or some sort of syncretistic mixture of nativist religion and Catholicism, having revelations all the time and wearing, you know, pretty elaborate vestments as well. You can find them on the internet easily. You can find them in London as well, actually.
The vestments that they wear are pretty spectacular.
Well, the vestments the Palmerians wear are astonishing. They're not necessarily any particularly good taste, but then I don't know if you ever went to an Anglo-Catholic church in the old days, they could look pretty gaudy as well.
That was Damien Thompson. For more on this subject, do tune in to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast, where Damien will be discussing it with Tony Trowbridge. Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend. Finally, in this week's issue, Eliza Seagrave explains why women fall for philanderers and bad boys. She joins me now, along with Sophia Money Coutts. So, Eliza, what do you think is the attraction of a bad boy?
It can be the energy, and they can be very funny. And as I said in the article, I think there's a biological thing with certain women, that the fact that they've seduced a lot of women makes them more attractive, because you think, well, all these other women like them, and probably also that they're very good at sex. So they've had a lot of experience.
Sure, that's probably part of it. Sophia, do you agree? Do you think there's a kind of innate attraction to a bad boy?
I do. I have known some bad boys in the past. I think it's a kick, isn't it? It's a thrill. It's like some people get their kicks from drugs. The kick from a bad boy can be totally the same thing, and you feel very alive and it's all exciting and it's a sort of, you know, 100 miles an hour relationship. So yeah, I think you can get sort of intoxicated by them. I certainly have anyway.
And when we say bad boy, what do we mean by that? Because the Harvey Weinstein thing is obviously the kind of extreme case, I'd say, of the bad boy. Are we talking about that?
Yeah, we have to be very careful, obviously, because Harvey, you know, Danny from Greece is a bad boy. Harvey is something completely, you know, something completely different. But I think, in my experience, men who don't, you know, perhaps treat you as women should be treated. You know, they might be seeing others or lying, or, you know, there's a whole gamut of problems, I would say.
And do you think it's easier now to be a bad boy in this era of kind of new technology? It's probably easier to kind of court lots of different women.
I think it's perhaps easier in terms of messaging and phones and everyone being sort of maybe more easily available. But the other thing is, it's probably easier to get busted for it as well, I think. I certainly know from experience that's true. So we've got that on our side as well, I think.
Elise, in your piece, you mentioned various bad boys you've fallen for. Do you kind of look back on it fondly, or do you look back on it and think, maybe I made a mistake?
Well, a mixture. I feel I've wasted time maybe when I could have been with someone nicer, but it were like the one-off experiences I mentioned, like being date raped on a sailing boat. This man who called himself Pirate Bill, but I was about 27. I suppose I didn't realise for 20 years that I'd been date raped, because I'd gone on the sailing boat and I had felt rather seasick. He then gave me this extremely knockout pill. But later I then realised, oh, I was date raped. But I didn't feel particularly antagonistic. I mean, I thought, oh, well, I willingly went along with the experience. You know, I went on a sailing boat with a stranger. Other people I've had longer relationships with, when I look at it intellectually, it's really disgraceful. I put up with the way I was bullied. But there was a side of me that thought they were being very macho. I mean, I've known three men with motorbikes, all that kind of thing, they're riding.
That's a sign. Boys and men with motorbikes.
It's a bit basic. One of them's incredibly nice. But it's a bit basic, quite frankly, a bit primitive, what I'm saying, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, do you think the reason you now can look back on it and say, you know, I was date raped or whatever, is because of, you know, people talking about it more nowadays?
Definitely.
And do you think that's a good thing, or do you
I think it's a very good thing that women are aware you don't have to be treated like shit. Yes, definitely.
Do you think it's one of those things that, kind of, in theory, the bad boy is quite a nice idea, but in practice people actually don't really like it?
Yes, exactly. I think, I mean, I had a, you know, period in my 20s, as I suppose probably a lot of us did, yes, as I said, thrilling at the bad boy, and possibly into my 30s as well. But I think you then realise, I can think of a particular relationship, how sort of damaging that can be, and then along hopefully comes someone lovely and you think, oh, actually this is more like it, this is what it should be, and I shouldn't be freak out and paranoid and worrying the whole time about where he is or what he's up to. So I think it is something you can kind of grow out of, or you master. And every now and then you might feel the pull of a bad boy, but hopefully once you've been burned, I think in my case anyway, you've hopefully learned to master it a bit.
I think you often know that when a man's very nice and caring, but he's not always as sexually attractive. I mean, I've got this very nice male friend, but then he always shoots himself in the foot by, he says something like, oh, I'm going to go and put my feet up. Which is a terrible terrible downer. But he couldn't be nicer or more considerate, because he's quite funny, but it's not, it doesn't quite cut the mustard.
But has he got children? Is he, you know, a great yes. father?
Yes, he's a very, very nice man in all sorts of ways.
Do you think nice men get overlooked for bad boys? Or do you think ultimately nice men prevail?
I'd hope that ultimately nice men prevail. I mean, I'm 32. I don't know if I know enough yet to judge that, but I would hope. Elisa may say differently.
I hope they do. I'm still not sure.
That was Elisa Seagrave and Sophia Money-Coutts. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you like the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Robert Toombs, Liam Halligan, and Melanie McDonough. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.